Welcome to Health Cetera in the Catskills on WIOX Radio. I'm Diana Mason, the host of this program, where we focus on the impact of local, state, national, and global issues on the health of the individuals, families, and communities in the Central Catskill region. And one of those global issues right now is the smoke that's coming down from Canada. And I want to urge everyone, if you're outside and you're being very active, to consider wearing a mask, maybe one of the ones you wore during COVID, that can prevent some of the particulate matter from getting into your lungs. Well, Health Cetera in the Catskills is broadcast from the WIOX radio station in Roxbury, New York, which is the ancient and unceded territory of the Esopus clan of the Lenape people, also known as the Munsee, who were the first caretakers living with this land. There is lots of poverty in this rural Catskill region, and we shouldn't underestimate the impact it has on the health and well-being of people and whole communities. Dr. Laura Samuel is an assistant professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing who's been researching the relationship between poverty and health. She was a co-author on a paper that came out earlier this year in JAMA on what's called food insecurity and cognitive impairment in older adults. I want to welcome Dr. Laura Samuel to Health Cetera in the Catskills. Thank you so much for joining me today, Laura.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a real joy.
So you've been studying this impact of low income on health, and I'm very interested in what got you interested in this topic, because some people know, but not a whole lot. But when I did my doctoral dissertation, when I did my doctoral work, I actually was going to do something on poverty and health. I got derailed, and that's a whole other story, but I did do a paper on ideas of poverty that was my candidacy paper. So I've continued to have a keen interest in this area, and I'm interested in what turned you to this topic.
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, I think my interest started very early in life. You know, my parents worked hard, and we fortunately, we were never in poverty, but certainly I could see that they were struggling to make ends meet sometimes. They had to work multiple jobs. And so I learned very early on that, you know, financial challenges are stressful and tiring for people. And then later when I became a nurse practitioner, I really began to put the pieces together about how that type of stress affects people's health and their well-being in very tangible ways, right? So increases the risk for chronic diseases like diabetes and heart disease. And so I really wanted to do something about that and went back to school and became a researcher and do what I do now.
So say a little bit more about what you saw in the practice and what you see as the impact and what we know from the evidence the impact has of poverty has on health.
Yeah, so we know that people who live in poverty, or even people above the poverty threshold, tend to have much worse health outcomes than their peers, right? So there's kind of a gradient here. It's not necessarily just about poverty versus not, but it's really about the idea that higher income levels, and especially having enough income to meet your specific household's needs, is really critical to ensuring that you have the resources that you need to protect your health, you know, sufficient food and medications and health care and adequate and clean housing. And we know that, therefore, people who are lower income tend to have poorer health outcomes because they don't always have consistent access to those things, and because of the stress that financial strain and poverty can have on people's health. So, you know, the health outcomes are pretty widespread. You know, we see chronic conditions like the ones I mentioned earlier, but we also see things like dementia, disability, and ultimately earlier death. And so we have people who have, you know, the chronic conditions that we might associate with older adults happen sometimes in very young populations in low-income communities, say. You know, worked in Baltimore, which is where I live, and, you know, I would treat people in their 20s and 30s with things like diabetes or heart disease. And these are conditions that we typically think only occur when people are in their 60s and 70s, but we tend to see it in much younger populations because of the effects of poverty and financial strain in health. And there's probably good reasons for this, you know, that we know that financial strain is stressful. You know, research that I've done has shown that financial challenges provoke inflammatory responses, the same type of inflammatory responses that we see with other stressful conditions, and that ultimately leads to disease. And then it's also probably due to the fact that people, with financial strain have, sometimes a lack of basic necessities, and they have to compromise basic necessities to make ends meet, right? So they may not have enough food to make it to the end of the month. We call that food insecurity. They may not have enough money left over after they pay the rent, and we call that housing insecurity. Mm-hmm. They may not be able to afford all their medications throughout the month also. So there's lots of ways that it kind of creates issues in terms of not having enough to balance the checkbook or balance the budget every month, and the compromises that people make that then lead to compromises in their health outcomes. And, you know, I think it's important to note, too, you know, my family, I'm a very pasty wife, can't tell that on the radio, but, you know, the typically, you know, there are disparities in financial strain because of structures of racism and ableism in our society. And so rates of financial strain and poverty are actually much higher in racially minoritized groups like Blacks or Native Americans, and higher among Hispanics, and then also notably higher among people with disabilities because of ableism in the workplace that really keeps them from being able to engage in the labor force and have enough employment to make ends meet on a regular basis.
And Laura, the segment that I aired before I had you on was by my colleague and Health Center correspondent Barbara Glickstein interviewing Liz Siegert, who's a health reporter on aging for the Association for Healthcare Journalists. And they were talking about Medicare coverage of dental care. And I for our listeners, I want to point out, because dental care is a real issue up here in Delaware County. It's few and far between. You have to usually leave the county. And what people don't realize, I think, is that your dental and oral health has a tremendous effect on your overall physical condition. And I think there's more and more evidence of this. Do you agree with that?
Oh, for sure. I mean, there's really good evidence that your loss of teeth contributes to an inability to really eat a variety of foods, which affect your health. But I think it's even more dramatic in that it's not always just about losing teeth, but also just the amount of bacteria that's in your mouth.
Yes.
And the quality of the teeth that you have that creates systemic inflammation and affects your metabolism in meaningful ways. And then those kind of physiologic mechanisms then ultimately trigger chronic conditions that we see in the clinic, like heart disease and obesity and diabetes.
Yeah, and I want to encourage people, if you think you have a tooth infection, do not put off seeing about it. It can go systemic and can really complicate your life. So you have also, I'm assuming you've had also patients who are food insecure. And sorry, what kind of nurse practitioner are you? Family, geriatric, what are
family.
You?
Family.
Mm-hmm. So you cover the whole gambit. So you're seeing older adults, and you're a co-author on a paper that was published in JAMA that looked at food insecurity and cognitive functioning on health. Tell us about that paper.
Yeah, so this is a paper that was really led by my terrific colleague, Bowen Kim, who's here at the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing. And she used 7 years of data that was collected from a national study of older adults. And in that study, they measured each person's cognitive function every year. And by cognitive function, I mean that they kind of had these people complete tests to capture their memory and their executive function. And so executive function includes the skills that you need to just kind of get stuff done. So those would be things like your ability to stay focused and organized and kind of your working memory, right? So not your long-term memory, but your ability to multitask and hold multiple pieces of information in your head at one time. And so she really found in this study that older adults who had food insecurity had faster declines in their executive function over time, which really suggests that a lack of sufficient food may lead to earlier dementia for these older adults. And this is notable because dementia obviously is a very costly condition. It's a very feared condition. It really affects people's lives in deep ways. And it affects their ability to continue to live independently. Mm-hmm. And most older adults want to continue to live independently in the community with their families and friends. And so this is meaningful because it suggests that there's disparities in dementia that are attributable to food insecurity, right? Mm-hmm. That if we could more meaningfully address food insecurity in our community, then we might be able to prevent some of the dementia and or at least prevent some of the decline to help people continue to live independently despite some cognitive impairment.
So how, as a nurse practitioner, how did you know if your patients were food insecure?
Yeah, so you know, the great thing is that there's actually really good, valid tools out there. The hunger vital sign is one tool that has been well used and time and time again. And it's a very simple two-question screener that can be used to kind of evaluate whether households are food insecure.
What are the questions?
So the questions include things like, in the past 12 months, did you worry about whether food would run out before you got money to buy more? And in the past 12 months, did the food that you bought not last and you didn't have any more money to get more food? I'm slightly paraphrasing, so those are probably the questions.
Yeah.
And so if people answer yes to either of those questions, then it's a sign that they may be food insecure and they should talk to somebody about that. Usually they need to get some sort of assistance, getting linked into food assistance programs like SNAP, which is formerly known as food stamps, or other programs that may meaningfully address food insecurity. And it's really important that, you know, we have more screening done consistently out in the communities because food insecurity and financial challenges more broadly are really stigmatizing. You know, a lot of people have told us in our research that they, you know, they felt like maybe they had done something wrong or that, you know, they didn't want to tell people about it. It was embarrassing. Mm. And so we really need to ask the right questions to be able to help people feel comfortable to tell us what they're really struggling with and then help them get the support that they need.
You know, we do have a high rate of poverty here in Delaware County, and it's including a high rate of child poverty. And we have food pantries in many of the towns in the area. I know there's one in Roxbury where the station is located. There's the food pantry, community food pantry over in Arkville, and there are others around the county. So there is support for the food pantries, but what mm-hmm. else would you suggest we need to do to prevent this food insecurity or respond to it?
Yeah, so you know, food pantries are a critical safety net for many people, but you know they can't be expected to address the total burden of food insecurity in the United States. I mean, the USDA, which keeps track of food insecurity rates, estimates that about 10% of the population is food insecure. And there are federal programs that are widely available to low-income households. The biggest of these programs is the SNAP program. It provides money every month for food to low-income households, and about 40 million people each year use the program.
And by the way, it's SNAP means the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And
yes,
as you said earlier,
it
used to be the food stamp, called food stamps. Yeah.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So, no, thanks for clarifying. So this program is really a critical mechanism that you know, the government has to try to address food insecurity as a public health issue. You know, we know that the SNAP program can reduce food insecurity in low-income households by as much as 30%. But the SNAP enrollment process can be very cumbersome. It's hard for some families to navigate the enrollment process. And so, you know, one thing that communities can do is to set up resources in their community, such as social service providers or agencies that can kind of help people navigate the enrollment process. Because many people who are eligible for the programs just don't enroll. This is particularly true for older adults. You know, the participation rate is always around 40% for older adults, meaning that more than half of the older adults who are eligible for SNAP don't actually use the benefit. And so, you know, that's one thing that communities can do. The other thing that people can do that's very timely right now is to advocate for the SNAP program, because right now in Congress, you know, your representatives are debating the reauthorization of the Farm Bill. The Farm Bill is a very large bill that funds the SNAP program. And so, you know, one very practical step that can be done is to encourage your representatives to increase funding and support for SNAP, to initiate kind of practices that would improve access to SNAP, you know, ask them to eliminate unnecessary requirements for the program. There's been a lot of conversation lately about work requirements in particular, right, as the debt ceiling conversations have gone on in recent weeks. And so there are many requirements and barriers that keep people from receiving SNAP benefits, even if they're low income and even if they're food insecure. So there are things that could be done. You know, the other thing with SNAP is, although it's terrifically helpful, some households only receive a small benefit amount. So the minimum benefit amount is about $20 right now, which is not really enough for most households. So,
not at all.
Yeah. So most advocates, you know, really kind of think that minimum should be bumped up. It's hard to do much at all with $20. And, you know, the other thing I'll add is, based on the qualitative research I've done and based on clinical practice, you know, people tell me it's not worth enrolling if you think you're only going to get $20.
Yeah.
And so bumping up the minimum benefit amount would make a big difference likely as well in terms of actually ensuring that people on SNAP can actually achieve food security, which really should ultimately be our goal of these types of programs.
And I believe that under the COVID emergency authorization or one of the acts that was passed related to COVID, there was an expansion of the SNAP program, recognizing that people had lost jobs, had reduced income, and they needed to be able to put food on the table because of the rise in hunger during that period. But that, I believe, has come to an end and thrown a lot of people out of the SNAP program. Do I have that right?
You're absolutely right. Yeah. So for a lot of households, their SNAP benefit amounts were bumped up to the maximum amount, and then the maximum amount was increased even further. And so households saw a sizable bump in their SNAP benefit amounts during the pandemic. But those benefits, you're right, have come to an end now. And so we're going back to the typical benefit calculations, which are considerably smaller. I mean, it differs depending on your household characteristics, mainly based on income and household size. But for a lot of households, they're seeing really sizable decreases in their SNAP benefits. And that's creating some real challenges for households in terms of their ability to kind of maintain food security.
You know, I just want to reiterate that it is a really good time for people to contact their congressional representatives, their U.S. senators, that the Congress is looking at this program, putting other restrictions. Some people want to expand it. So whatever your position may be, and I'm hoping this program has helped to inform your position on this, we hope that you will pay attention and talk to your neighbors, talk to your friends about how we all can support each other when times are hard. I also want to point out that Delaware Opportunities, which I think is a fabulous organization, it is a one-stop shop social service agency in Delaware County, Laura, and there are some people nationally who wish that their counties had one-stop shops. And so it's a dedicated team of people who are addressing the needs of individuals and families, including older adults in our county, and they do address food insecurity. And so I would encourage people who would like more information about signing up for the SNAP program or seeing if you're qualified to contact Delaware Opportunities. You can contact them by their website is DelawareOpportunities.org, DelawareOpportunities.org. And their phone number is 607-746-1600. That's 607-746-1600. And I personally, I'm privileged to not need a food pantry. I want to make sure that my friends, my neighbors, people in my community are not food insecure, or that we're supporting them during difficult times. So I do try to make donations to the local food pantry as well as to Delaware Opportunities whenever I can, and I'd encourage other listeners to do likewise. Well, Laura, Samuel, I really appreciate this conversation, and continue in this work. It's really important work, and I'm grateful for your sharing it with us on Health Center in the Catskills.
Well, thanks so much for talking with me and considering it yourself today. I think it's really important to understand that food insecurity is a health issue and understand then why we're advocating so much for things like SNAP.
And that's Dr. Laura Samuel, a nurse practitioner and assistant professor at the Johns Hopkins University School of Nursing. Have a great day, Laura.